Okay, so let's begin with a very quick review. As I said at the outset, the shiurim are going to build on each other, but I'll try to make sure that there's some review so that each one stands as an independent unit, can be independently understood. So basically what we saw last time is that there is a dispute regarding how one sets up a basin in certain circumstances. We call it basin shel zavla zeh borer lo echad. Basically what we saw was that there are two ba'alei dinim, Reuven and Shimon, the two litigants in a case, in a monetary dispute. And the question became, how exactly should they set up the basin that they are selecting to adjudicate or decide who is Zakai, who is Chayev, who is the winner, who is the loser? Rabbi Meir said, everybody agreed that Reuven chooses one judge, Shimon chooses his own judge, Shimon chooses a judge. And then the question became, how is the third judge? We know that we need three. How is the third judge selected? How is he chosen? So according to Rabbi Meir, the first two then get together and they choose a third judge. According to the Chachamim, the first two judges are the ones who choose a third judge. Okay, and among other things that we saw last week, we'll as the shiur goes on, we'll begin to revisit some of the things that we saw last week. But the Gemara asks, why do they go through this whole procedure of having, you know, Reuven choose one, Shimon choose a second, and then together choose a third? The Gemara says, Kadesha Yetze Hadin La'amita. We have that line so that the justice should emerge properly from the case, that you'll get a truthful verdict in the case. Kedesha Yetzei Hadin La'amita. And we began exploring what exactly Yetzei Hadin La'amita means. We saw two perspectives in Tosfos. One perspective in Tosfos was, what does it mean, Kedesha Yetzei Hadin La'amita? Why do they go through this whole procedure, Reuven choosing one, Shimon choosing a second, and together choosing a third? One perspective in Tosfos, the position of the Rivan, was that this way, the litigants will abide by the court's decision, even if they lose. Even if I lose, I'll abide by the court's decision. Why? Because each one will think, my judge advocated for me. After all, I selected him. He must have advocated in my favor. And if the court still decided against me, they must have been correct. I must have truly lost the case. That's the position of the Rivan. Tosfos then note, however, that the simple implication of the Gemara is that Kedesha Yetzei Hadin La'amita is not about their willingness to abide by the court's decision. It is about the court's ability to arrive at the correct decision. And Tosfos argued, the second day in Tosfos, was that indeed, each judge that is appointed by their respective Ba'alei Dinim actually advocates for those Ba'alei Dinim. So when Reuven appoints one judge, that judge advocates for Reuven. When Shimon appoints one judge, that judge advocates for Shimon. And then the third judge will be the one who effectively decides, or is the one who kind of tips the balance and decides the case. And it's also said that seems to be pashas in the Gemara. Lafum riyata mashma. We noted that did indeed seem to be pashas in the Gemara, but why did the Rivan reject that? Because it is an astonishing suggestion that a judge in a case can be overtly biased in favor of one of the two litigants. And not only are they overtly biased, but they're instructed to be overtly biased. We are telling them the way you should judge this case is in favor of one of the two parties. And we noted that is most probably why the Rivan rejected that explanation and went with his own explanation. So that left us to explain how in the world you could have Tosfos arguing that you have overtly biased judges. Yeah, Shmuel.
So are they totally overtly biased, or just to bring up the arguments?
Okay, good. So we'll get to the Rush in a second. But yeah, 100%. That's what the Rush is going to argue. But from Tosfos, if we just revisit that, let's revisit source 1 for 1 second. In the middle of line 2, you have Lefum Riata Mashma, Kacha Pirush, Shemitosha, Biru Zeshalo, Vezeshalo, Ushnehem Hashlishi, that's, we noted the Bach's addition to this Tosfos, Yetze Adin La Amito Beloavos, they'll come to the right conclusion without any perversion of justice, Sheye Eha Inyan Shakol, because everything will be balanced, and you have equal advocates for one side that you will have for the other side. It sounds like they are really advocating. Now, maybe before we get into the conceptual ramifications of how we can understand this position of Tosfos, let's because Shmuel wrote it up, let's take a look at the Rush in Source 3. Now, the Rush not only articulates what we were saying for the Rivan, that he rejects the notion that you could have overtly biased judges. He very adamantly does so. I think we alluded to this at the beginning of, at the very end of last year. This is the Rush in Source 3. This is Perek Gimel Siman Beis. V'mnei sheyesh chisrei hada'as to'in bedivrei Rashi. So he already starts by saying that there are people who lack wisdom. Usually when you dispute another position, you don't begin, at least in the Rishonim, we don't begin by mocking it as people who are chisrei das, right? They lack wisdom. They make an overt error within Divrei Rashi. V'lomdin mimenu, and what do they learn from Rashi? What do they try to take out from Divrei Rashi? Sha'adayin yeshlo lahapich b'schus oso shabirer. That the Dayan is supposed to indeed advocate for the person who appointed him, but Omeid bin Komo lachpos bedvarim ashalokedin, and really effectively stand in his place to influence the din, even influence the outcome of the case, even if it's not in accordance with the proper halacha. He's effectively arguing that there are some who felt that Rashi's position is that the Dayan is not so much a judge as much as he is a sleazy attorney. He's not supposed to be worried about what's true or what's untrue. What is he supposed to do? His job is to advocate for his client. V'nahagu kama anashim, and the Rush says that apparently this was actually common practice, or at least somewhat practiced. V'nahagu kama anashim, libror lahem ba'al tachbulos v'nitlim b'divrei Rashi. Shemashra yir lahabi b'schusam. They would deliberately hire these tricksters, these people who practiced in sophistry. They were able to pull these tricks of the tongue and manipulate the halacha in all sorts of different ways. And they would say, oh, this is Rashi. Then the Rush, in line 3, adds two words. V'chalila v'chas. Chalila v'chas. The Rush is not just saying that this is wrong, but this is offensive to him. Chas v'shalom, should this be true? Well, we noted, I think, last time, that when a Rishon says chalila v'chas, it means they have a really intense, not just they think something is wrong, but that they really believe that something is fundamentally flawed or religiously offensive about the suggestion, chalila v'chas, that Rashi should be advocating some system in which you hire people to obscure justice rather than obtain justice. Lodiktiku b'dvarav, because of the savri hare'eni birarti. We noted this last time in Rashi. They didn't pay close attention to Rashi. Does Rashi say that they actually misrepresent justice? No. He says that the ba'alei dinim, like the Rivan said, they will think that each one will represent that he's representing my case, and because I think that my judge is representing my case, I will abide by the court's decision. But chalila v'chas, that the judges themselves should actually pervert justice. Ki yusover kach she'yehape b'schusa, yosur mi b'schusa acher. We told that tzayis l'dineihim, because of this they will abide by the decision. Avala dayan atzmo, the Rush says, this is the 1, 2, 3, 4, fourth line, in the middle of the line after the period. He should never forward any idea unless he thinks it is absolutely true. If he even thinks that it might be correct, but he's not firmly convinced, and he tricks his friends, lahatos chaveru, he tricks the other judges into believing that, that is a perversion of justice. There's no justification for that. Now here's the problem. The Rush firmly, adamantly rejects the position of Rashi. But what does the Rush himself say? Something that's strikingly similar to what Rashi says. Look at the underline in the Rush. So what does happen here? Av mitosha ze biriro. Because, let's say, Dayan number 1 was appointed by Reuven. That Dayan understands where Reuven's coming from. Mevin dvarav leishuro. He'll understand his case for his benefit. And if there's anything that he can pull up in favor of that litigant, he'll bring that up to the other Dayanim. And the second one does seem as if indeed he is representing the second Baal Din, the second litigant. There isn't going to be any advantageous argument for either side that will be uncovered. In other words, all arguments will be uncovered. And the third listens, and he's the one who's machriya, he's the one who decides what's true. So, after the Rush very adamantly rejected Rashi, he suggests something that at face value is strikingly similar to Rashi. Right? What's the critical difference between the Rush and Rashi?
It's not that the judge is trying to find studim to the schus of whoever appointed him. It's more that he's there to, because he knows him best, and he can understand, he understands the way that he's presenting his case best. he understands that if he's that the reason why he looked nervous is because he's a nervous person, not because he's lying.
But the Rush does focus on Tzad Zchus that each one has. I mean, I think what you're saying is essentially correct.
Right, so
but
he says Mitoch Shezeh Bir, or maybe in Dvar,
right.
So it's because he explained it to him specifically, he understands it.
Right. So what it seems like the Rush is what it seems like the Rush is saying is that each one is not so much a lawyer who's advocating for his side, but he's almost like you have two investigators, right? That we all know from the beginning of Law and Order that in the American justice system there are two separate but equally important bodies or something like that. So the Rush is arguing that effectively in Zavla you have a conflation of those two. I don't know if you'd have two sounds at the end or just one sound at the end. That would be the nafkamina, perhaps, okay? But you're having effectively this court where the judges are serving as investigators. So judge number one, I was appointed by Reuven. So what am I going to do? I am going to assess Reuven's case. And I will know any advantageous argument for Reuven. The purpose here is so that no argument is uncovered. I'll know all of the arguments in favor of Reuven. The second Dayan will know all the arguments in favor of Shimon. Does that mean I'm going to side with Reuven? Not necessarily. But at least the court will be aware of all of the arguments. Now, someone asked last week, I don't remember, what is the... We said, Yetzi Adin La'amito, so that the court is balanced, right? So why is that any... Oh, I think you were asking this, Josh. So why is it any more balanced than just three unbiased judges? So the answer for the Rush would be clear. Yetzi Adin La'amito, because of, not the bias, but because of the intimate understanding that each one has of his respective Baal Din's case, they'll be able to uncover all of the arguments that are necessary. But how do we understand Rashi? And lest you say that Rashi just seems like a crazy position that's totally, or the Chisrei Da'as that the Rashi dismisses are totally out of line. They clearly, after all, they are Chisrei Da'as, right? They lack wisdom. So maybe it's not worth paying attention. Take a look at source 4, the Adrama. The Adrama is one of the early Chachmei Svarad from Muslim Swin, I think. If I remember correctly. So look at the underline in the Adraman source 4. My time at Kadesh Heza Mahape Paskuso Shal Baal Din, Zeshe Biriro, Ta'ala Mahape Paskuso Shal Sheni She Biriro. So again, he's using that same language of Tosfos, that one judge is advocating for his litigant, the other is advocating for his litigant. Shlishi Shenes Ratzu Bo Shnehem, Ein Da'ato Noto La Echad Mehem Yasser Mechavero, Ela Machriyas Devreim La Emes. Now, the Yadrama adds one following line, which I was surprised by. I don't know how much to make of this line. I pose it to you to think about it. The Adrama concludes, V'adin nigmar b'shneihem b'nimtza adin yotzei la'amita. The nigmar adin b'shneihem, and the case will be completed by the two of them, or the verdict will be completed by the two of them, niyotzei adin la'amita, and you'll end up with a truthful, correct outcome. What's surprising about the language of the Adrama, at least to me? What? Shneihem. V'adin... V'adin nigbar b'shneihem. The assumption of the Rama, is what? That it's going to be a two-on-one. Now, if you adopt the position of the Rush, is it true that every time there's going to be two Dayanim against one Dayan? Not at all. It's quite conceivable that I'll investigate Reuven's case, I'll learn everything I can about Reuven's case, and still come to the ultimate conclusion that Shimon is the one who has the stronger case. The Rama seems to be assuming that it is going to be, it's rigged, right? One of them is automatically going to be voting on one side, the other is automatically going to be voting on the other side, and the third is the machria. Now you can't claim I'm reading too much into this. You could just be saying, b'derech klal, it will be nigmar b'shneihem. But if you take it at face value, the Adrama seems to be advocating a position that's awfully similar to the one that the Rush rejected out of hand, and we very much associate with the reason why the Rush rejected it. How in the world can you have a Beis Din where two of the Dayanim embrace an open bias?
You're saying that Bishneim is with the neutral judge and one of the biased judges?
Yeah.
Okay.
How else do you read that?
I don't know. It's just that he used Shneim in reference to the two biased judges, like,
where?
Earlier in that same sentence.
Where? No, the third judge who was wanted... The third, that's referring to the two litigants. It can't be the same Shneim, right? The third judge that was wanted by both litigants.
Well, that's.
I think the fact that Rehem is also.
Oh, you're saying if you adopt. Okay, within the position of the Chachamim, Shneihem is referring to those two Dayanim.
Right.
Correct. Yeah, but I think it's clear Nigmar Shneihem is not referring to the first two. I don't think that makes sense. In other words, it refers to each of the opposing judges.
I thought it might be that enigmar vishneihem, meaning like they'll have to hash it out, and someone's going to have to. The din is going to be settled when one of them gives in to the other.
The two is referring to the first
right.
two judges, and that
meaning the whole case is dependent
be,
on
yeah.
them. The neutral one is going to.
I mean, no, but if you look at what it's coming off of, right? Let's just read this through. Ein da'ato not... Sorry. V'hashlishi, starting with that last word on the second line. V'hashlishi shenisratzu bo shneim ein da'ato not le'echad mehem yasem mechaveru ela machriya es devreim la'emes. V'adin, right? So he's coming off of the shlishi. V'adin nigmar b'shneim. I don't know. To me, that means the shlishi and whoever he's siding with. I'm still not sure. How are you... How is it the two who are opposing each other?
Yeah, din nigmar, it's going to be final. Once the neutral guy is going to come up with an objective opinion.
Right.
Yeah, din nigmar bishneihem, meaning it's going to, the din is going to rely on the two to agree on the verdict.
Well, you don't need the, both of them to agree once the third one is machriya.
Is that true? You need
halacha karov. Yeah, no, you always halacha karov,
right?
It's a good question. Why, right? That's Tosa's famous question at the beginning of right in hocham mamonach harov. Why do we go after two or three? Fine,
right.
Tosa give two answers there, and the famous Rav Chaim about. So, the intuition of saying we should need a majority is not a unanimous decision is a good one, but yeah, we certainly follow the rov. Additional point
on a different issue.
Yeah.
It seems, looking at the language of Rashi, it's interesting, and actually all of the Rishonim, they use language like, mehapchin b'zchuto, which is language you mostly see in criminal cases, like when you have a Beit Din of 23, and they are trying to figure out whether this guy should be, executed, so then they try to be mehapich bizchuta. They're trying to come up with reasons why it is that this guy should not be executed. It's odd here because
clearly we're dealing with dinim mamonos,
right?
Right.
But it's almost as if there is a precedent for the idea of a judge being biased.
It's not a bad idea. I mean, certainly right. Certainly if
there is even also in civil cases, like the only precedent I can think of maybe is we have this thing of ta'aninan, that if you have like
we may or may not have ta'aninan.
Right. Okay, but you have there is the possibility
right.
that if you have a litigant who
right.
might not do a very
can't
good
can't present
of,
themselves,
so
yeah.
So the judge will intentionally present what the litigant's argument is.
But that's not, okay.
It's a little
different.
It's limited,
yeah.
But still.
And it might depend on the scope of ta'aninan. What Jerry's referring to is a principle called ta'aninan, which means we make the claim. It comes up in a number of times in Shas, most famously in the beginning of Maseches Gittin, where Tosos discuss it, where we advocate an argument for somebody who can't advocate for themselves. But I think that's different, right?
That is different, for sure. I'm just saying that there is precedent, certainly in criminal court,
so that I actually like, because that might be a perfect precedent for what the Rosh is saying. In other words, we know that Beis Din has the Torah instructs them to have a bias towards Zechus in cases of Dinei Nefashos, right? V'yitzilu ha'eda is the source. So they're supposed to have that bias, but at the same time, obviously their arguments
right.
have to be sound.
Right, and it's different here because one man's Zechus is another man's
Chova. It's interesting that you mentioned Mahapech. If you look in Source 5, the Lashon of the Yerushalmi, there, it's not mehapech schuso, it's meradef schuso. He'll chase his schus. So if we take the pashas of the Yerushalmi, or the Ramah, or this Deya that's presented in the Rosh, the question is, how can you have these biased judges? How is it going to be, assuming that we're not going to go to the excesses of the Rosh, that they're deliberately distorting the din, how is it that you're going to have this bias? And we said that perhaps this relates to a very fundamental question, conceptual question, underlying the entire nature of this based in Shel Zavla. And the question is as follows. Or background. And we discussed this again at the very end of last year. In Halacha, we have two, broadly speaking, two structures for dispensing justice in the context of monetary law in Chosh and Mishpah. We have one called Din, and another called Pshar. Din is the formal structure of based in, of the Halachic hierarchy of the court system that rules based on the halachos of choshen mishpat, the areas of halacha that govern interpersonal monetary law. And pshara, by contrast, is a form of arbitration. It's arbitration. It's often translated as compromise. It's not really compromise, it's really arbitration. What it means is that you're going to a chacham, or a group of people, who are going to decide a case, not by opening up a choshen mishpat, but by their broader sense of tzedek, by their broader sense of what's right. An example that Rav Shechter is fond of quoting was a case where Rav Chaim apparently was asked to arbitrate in the following case. There was a wealthy, and I don't know about the historicity of the case, but they don't tell these stories about you and me. So there was apparently a wealthy woman, wealthy Balabasta, who had working for her a less wealthy maidservant. But this less wealthy woman apparently had one piece of jewelry or something to that effect, some ornamentation that was handed down to her and her family. It was a very fancy piece, and it was such a nice piece that one time her employer asked to borrow it from her, and she lost it. So they came to Rav Chaim, and Rav Chaim, as is the halacha, first offered them to do pshara. A Beis Din is always supposed to offer first, would you rather do pshara than din? And they said, yes. So Rav Chaim said, okay, so pay her for the object that you lost. And pshara, what do you mean? Split it 50-50. So why did Rav Chaim ask to do pshara? Because if they would have done it on choshen mishpat, she actually would have been petura. She actually would not have had to pay. Why? Anyone know? There's a principle called...
Right?
Sorry?
It's onus. She didn't lose it on purpose.
It doesn't make a difference. She was a shoel. So, and it would be... I don't know if it would be... the shoel is chayav in pretty much everything. So it doesn't... Right? She was borrowing it. There's a principle called bi'alav imo. It's bi'alav imo that... The Chumash tells us that if you lend something to a person, if I lend my ox to someone, and he also hires me to work in the fields, because he's employing both me and the ox, if something happens to the ox, he has no responsibility. Because if I'm there, I'm expected to, I guess, take some responsibility for what's going on. That's the principle of Be'alav Imam. So, if you had just opened up a Choshen Mishpat, then this wealthy woman would have been Petura, because the poor maidservant lent her the object, but also was under her personal hire. She was working for her as well. So Be'alav Imo would have dictated that she was pater for losing the object. Pshara, well, if you're dealing with tzedek, you know, you have this poor woman who has this one piece, and the other woman lost it, not by any malicious intent, but she still lost this piece that was owned by the other woman. So Rav Chaim said, pay her back for the piece that you lost. And they didn't split it 50-50. It wasn't a compromise. It was arbitration. In other words, as the Rambam says, any system, even a perfect legal system, will always have certain cases that don't fit into the necessarily original intent, we'll say, of the halachos themselves. So you take the broader spirit of tzedek, the broader spirit of mishpat, and you use that to judge the case. That's what pshara is. That's why Rav Chaim said you have to pay. So you have pshara, which is arbitration and din. Where does zavla fit in? Where does zebor lo echad fit in? One extreme option is to say Zebor lo echad is a Beis Din. Just like any other Beis Din, it firmly fits within the realm of Din. Just like any other Beis Din. It happens to have a unique method of appointment because, let's say, we want the two litigants to abide by the decision, whatever the decision may be. But in terms of the Beis Din's force, in terms of its own stature, in terms of how it operates, it's operating on the basis of any other Beis Din. It's a full Beis Din. The opposite extreme is to say that Zavla is little more than an elevated form of Pshara. Souped up Pshara, it's a Pshara on steroids. It's not fully arbitration the way Pshara is. There is some kind of formal structure. But if we had to sort this somewhere, it's not in the realm of Din, it's not in the realm of Beis Din, it's in the realm of arbitration, of Pshara. Now, if that's the case, then we can begin to understand why we might have the flexibility to say either the judges aren't really judges, they're investigators. Or even more extreme, that they actually have an implicit bias whereby they're advocating on behalf of a particular client. Because it's not a formal din, it's a form of arbitration. Now, with that in mind, with that broad hakira in mind, there's going to be much to explore. But the first thing I want to explore is the basic machlokas that we saw between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah. We saw that there were three machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim in the Mishnah. One of which we're going to leave aside for now, because as I mentioned then, last week, it's a bit more complicated than it appears in the Mishnah. The Gemara and Daf HaGimel is going to further explore it. But let's deal with the first two. Number one, first machlokas, who appoints the third judge? Is it the Baalei Dinim, the litigants? That's Rabbi Meir's position. Or is it the Dayan, The first two judges appoint the third judge. That's the position of the Chachamim. Seems like almost an arbitrary machlokas. Why is there value to one position over another? Question number one. Question number two. Can I disqualify the other person's judges? According to Rabbi Meir, if I don't like the way the other guy's judge looks, or the way he talks, or the way he sounds, I can just disqualify him. According to the Chachamim, you can't just disqualify someone. You need to bring proof that, indeed, there is some form of formal psul. There's a formal disqualification. Now, with this broad question about Zeborer in mind, and I pose this as a question because I'm not sure myself, is it possible to better explain the machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chacham? To actually explain what's going on in our Mishnah. So often we just read a Mishnah, and we read, okay, three machlokas, and we passively absorb, because that's what we're trained to do often. There's a certain value to that, na'aseh v'nishma, right? But what Talmud Torah asks us to do is not just accept, but think about what are Rabbi Meir and the Chacham actually arguing about. It seems pretty arbitrary. The Ba'alei Dinim versus Dayanim, who's choosing the third judge, who cares, right? And I promise you they didn't flip a coin and just decide that. So what is the inner logic that's going on behind it? What are they actually arguing about?
You have thought on this? Just using the framework that you're using now, you could try to pin Rabbi Meir on the side of more of a pshara and come more on the side of a din, because...
So why? Flesh that out.
Because for Rabbi Meir, it's really about the wishes of each side, and if they don't like the way he looks or whatever other random reason there may be, it's just throw him aside because it's about really them.
Does that make sense? Does anyone think that makes sense?
If it's not, then why can you just throw it away? If you're just advocating for the other person, why does it matter?
Very good. So, excellent. So, I'm not sure where to go with this. My initial intuition was when I saw the Machlokes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim was exactly the way Shmuel was going. In other words, we noted that Rabbi Meir elevates the power of the litigants, of the Ba'alei Dinim. What would that initially seem to imply? Pshara. So, therefore, who chooses the third Dayan? If I'm in the case, if it's arbitration, I'm going to choose the third judge. There's no independent power of the first two judges. All the power rests within the consensus of the Ba'alei Dinim. Whatever they agree to, they wield all the power in the case because it is a form of arbitration. I am going to choose the third judge. You want to appoint this guy? I don't like him. I don't have to give you a reason. If it's arbitration, I could just decide that I don't like him and I'm going to get rid of him. So Rabbi Meir is consistent in both in maintaining what? That it's a form of pshara, whereas the Chachamim hold that it's a form of din. And I think this is reflected, Shmuel's approach is reflected in two sources. Number one is the Yerushalmi in source 6, which is a bit obscure. There are different ways of reading this Yerushalmi. Very often the Yerushalmi is cryptic, both because it's harder to read than the Bavli, and also because we don't have Rashi. So it's a little bit hard, and there are different ways of reading this Yerushalmi, the Ridvaz and the Pnei Moshe. I don't know the biographical info on either of them. I heard the Ridvaz was a Rav in Chicago.
Yeah.
And like when, the early 1900s?
Yeah, or 1800s.
Yeah, he was a Rav in Chicago. Clearly Talmud Chacham, he wrote a Pirush on the Yerushalmi. But it's like very late. We're talking very late. But there were two different ways of reading this Gemara, and the way the Ridvaz reads it here is particularly interesting. My time with Rabbi Meir, the Yerushalmi asks, what's the reason Rabbi Meir? We want all three of them to be appointed by one das. Right? I guess what that means is that if each one can reject the other person's, and he doesn't, then you have a consensus, some form of consensus, at least on all three. Even if I'm initiating the appointment, if the other person doesn't reject him, then there's at least some consensus. And what's my time of Drabbanan? Lav kula minach mivcharu mesa ma de'at ba'i. It's not in all your hands to decide what you want. But rather, I and you will choose which judges we want. That's a very cryptic language. What exactly does that mean? According to Rabbi Meir also, you could have made the same argument, right? In other words, if Reuven is saying to Shimon, there are two ways of reading this line. One is, Reuven says to Shimon, you can't choose everybody yourself. I have to be part of the process as well. That's the case, and that doesn't justify the Chachamim any more than Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir also holds that there needs to be some consensus. The alternative, I think the way the Ridvaz reads it, is that who's talking here? Lav kula minach. It's not one litigant talking to the other. It's the judges talking to the Ba'alei Dinim. This is not all in your hands to decide how this case is going to go. So don't think that you wield all the power here. Rather, there is a certain independent power of the Dayanim themselves. They have a certain independent power by virtue of the fact that it's a formal court system. and therefore they are the ones who choose the third dayan. That's the way the Radvaz reads it. So again, the way the Yerushalmi is phrasing this machlokas is that the justification of the Chachamim, in contrast to Rebbe Meir, is that not all the power lies with the Ba'alei Din. Which are you... then he's turning to the other judge, I guess.
Okay.
It's quite a difficult passage in the Yerushalmi. I think if you read it the other way, then it just doesn't justify the Chachamim over Rebbe Meir, which is probably... The Pnei Moshe reads this as just a standard interpretation that, oh, we're both going to take part in the process. I think that's difficult because it doesn't explain why the Chachamim over Rebbe Meir. The way the Radvaz learns it, and I didn't have the Radvaz on Bar Ilan, so it's not printed here. But at least in my version. Is that it's a statement from the judges to the Ba'alei Din. Another is the Hagos Ashri in Sanhedrin Perakimel. The Hagos Ashri is a commentary on the Rush. He says, "V'alacha kachachamim, we paskin like the chachamim, v'yesh lomod mikan." And the Hagos Ashri wants to derive something from the fact that we hold like the chachamim. Heicha debiru eshnei adayanim. They appointed the two judges. V'ta'anu lefneihem she'ein ba'alei dinin yicholin lomor ledayanin al tishalu dinei lefnei ploni tamen chacham. Ela b'fnei ploni. Let's say you have the following case. Two litigants come to the first two judges, and they say, if you need help in this case, I want you to go to Talmud Chacham X, but not Talmud Chacham Y. Do they have the right to tell their judges who they should further the case to, who they should appeal the case to, who they should ask the case to, or do they not? Do they or do they not? So the argument of the Hagos Ashri is that in such a case, it says, Halacha Chachamim, Lo Ba'i Da'as Ba'alei Dinin. Because we hold like the Chachamim, they do not have the right to tell them which Talmud Chacham they should go to. Implication, if we held like Rabbi Meir, then they would have the right to tell them that. Now, how does he extrapolate that from Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim? So it's the same thing. Look at what he says. He says, his whole point is, once you paskin like the Chachamim, then the Ba'alei Dinin's influence on this case is limited. All they have the right to do is appoint those first two Dayanim. Beyond that, they have no influence on the outcome of the case at all. They can't legislate to, they can't tell the Dayanim who they should go to and who they can't. We don't need their Haskama. We don't need their consensus. But the implication would be, if we paskin like Rabbi Meir, then they would be able to tell them, go to Dayan, to Talmud Chacham Ploni, but not to Talmud Chacham Ploni. Again, implying that the Machlokas is exactly what Shmuel was saying. That Dayanim have, the Ba'alei Dinim have greater power, according to Rabbi Meir. According to Rabbi Meir, perhaps it's a Pshara. According to the Chachamim, it's Din. So this whole conceptual question that we're raising may actually underlie the very Machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim in the Mishnah. Now, what gives me pause in saying that? What gives me pause to know what you were saying before?
It's Pshara.
You can actually flip the entire thing on its head and argue that exactly the opposite is true. Let's take the second machlokas about disqualifying the other person's judge, right? So what Shmuel is arguing is that if it's pshara, then I don't need to bring a proof that the guy's pasul. I could just get rid of him. Everything is based on the haskamas ba'alei dinim. Everything is based on my consensus. If I don't agree, then I have the right to reject it. But ironically, if we take arbitration to the nth degree, to the most extreme version of arbitration, that other person's judge, what is his role?
It's for him.
To advocate for him. So if Reuven appoints his own judge, and Shimon appoints his own judge, right? And the role of each one is to advocate for the respective parties, what say in the world does Shimon have in who's representing Reuven? So ironically, while my initial intuition was exactly like yours, if we take arbitration a step further, we can actually flip the machlokas on its head and argue that the exact opposite is true. According to the Chachamim, I can't reject the other person's chosen judge. Why? That's his representative. What say in the world do I have in rejecting his representative? According to Rabbi Meir, he's my judge just like he's the other person's judge. So I have a say in whether or not I want to accept him. Take the first machlokas about who appoints the third judge, right? What I could say according to the Chachamim is that the first two judges, right? The Chachamim hold that the two judges appoint the third one, right? So until now we were saying, oh, that indicates that they have some independent koach, they have some independent power, and that independent power gives them the right to choose a third judge. But again, we could flip it on its head. We could say that why is it that the two judges have the right to choose? not out of independent power, but as a form of shlichus, as a form of representation of the Baal Edinim. In other words, once I have appointed my judge as my representative, he won't only be my representative in the masa umatan of the case, he'll be my representative in choosing the third judge. And Shimon's chosen judge, he will be his representative in choosing the third judge. According to Rabbi Meir, I don't have representatives. I've just chosen a judge. A judge who's unbiased and impartial. Once that's the case, would he be able to go forward and choose a third judge for me on my behalf? Certainly not. So, just that hakira itself, of whether it's arbitration or din, may explain the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, but it's unclear in which direction. I think a strong case can be made that this chakir can work in either direction. That either Rabbi Meir is the one who holds pshara, like the implication certainly of the Hagos Hashri, B'Shem Ha'or Zarua, or you can make the case that Rabbi Meir is the one who favors din. You can make the case that the Chachamim are favoring din, you can make the case that the Chachamim are favoring pshara. I really think it's malleable.
How can you say make the case that Rabbi Meir is favoring din?
So when it comes to...
I understand the Chachamim and pshara maybe, but why Rabbi Meir and din?
So, why? Which part? Give which?
I can understand if we're going...
away
with arbitration, then...
Right, so what part of Rabbi Meir gives you trouble?
Why would you be able to just reject the other person?
Oh, you'd say that there's even though it's formal din, there's still, it's part of the appointment procedure, enables me to reject the other guy's dayan. In other words, almost because he is a dayan for both of us, even though he's the one who's taking the initiative on appointing him, I still must have the right to reject him. Almost because of the fact that that's an objective-based thing. Yeah.
It sounds like there's some kind of imprecision in exactly what we want out of Pshara, meaning that on the one hand we want, or it could be that Pshara is intended to make everyone happy, and that's really just the goal of Pshara is that everyone should be happy in the end. Or
you're asking a broad Pshara question?
Yeah, but I
it relates.
It's
yeah,
going
okay.
to relate
yeah.
to this. Don't worry. Whereas... or is the goal really to do what's right in some sort of global sense beyond... And those two are, like, the opposite things, meaning it could be that really we'd all be happy with a horribly unequal din, or at least one of us will be happy and the other of us will be paid off or something like that.
Right.
That would work, that would be a great thing that would make everyone happy, but that's not Pshara. So it's almost like one half of Pshara is really real din, just in a more... cosmic sense, and the other half is
Pshara. So this is a broad question in what Pshara
right.
is. I think it's a good question.
So
just one thing I would qualify is that I don't know if they're necessarily opposites, because if you take Pshara in terms of the broader sense of justice, one of the things that one might consider in that regard is Shalom as well. In other words, if you change it slightly in terms of
right.
Pshara being what is best, not necessarily in terms of a strict justice sense, but in terms of like a broader perception of the best way to proceed. For example, you're dealing with like a machlokas, an intra-family machlokas, which unfortunately happens quite frequently. One sense of pshara may be that, as opposed to ruling just strictly in favor of the person who's technically right, that there is some kind of broader value in appeasing each party so that there's some sense of shalom that's maintained within the family. So I don't know if they're necessarily opposites in all cases or in general. I mean, I think they can work hand in hand. I understand what you're saying, but I wouldn't say they're opposites. They're different. They're not opposites.
Yeah, maybe. I think it depends on how much you think that, you know, societal peace is in itself a form of justice. But okay, which you said. In this case, in the Mishnah, it sounds like that Rabbi Meir, it's not that he specifically has Pshara and Chachamim have Din, or that it sounds like Rabbi Meir wants everyone to get what they want. It's almost like a business, like Zabla is a business deal. Like, you and I have agreed that we can't agree on who wins in this, you know, whatever case, so we agree to a business deal wherein each of us is going to pick a judge, and that each of those judges is going to pick a... third judge.
Or for Mayor, the two of them are going to pick a third judge.
Correct. And then in the, when we, you know, write a contract that stipulates that whoever, wins among these three judges gets the money. It's essentially
what
we're doing.
Is that more than the Chacham? In other words, why is that more so?
There are rules because we care more about what actually, we care about either din or the, you know, Shara form of din, where we want at least some sort of, you know, global justice. But what you want and what I want doesn't matter. There are rules. Is that
really true for the Chachamim? I mean, again, it's not.
Why would you say that? Why would the Chachamim say that why should there be rules at all? So the only reason there should ever be rules is.
I'm arguing because it pertains to a formal based in structure, which always has
correct.
Rules.
So I'm saying, I think that's correct, but I want to put it on the opposite side of, you know, of what I'm saying about Rabbi Meir, who seems to be saying, like, you know, everyone should just be happy, you know, we're coming together in a contract. We're saying this isn't a contract.
Maybe,
this
I don't,
there are
I'm not
rules.
Sure,
like,
I'm not sure. Again, let's just deal with the second machlokas. Each person can disqualify the other person's judge. Is that making everyone happy? You disqualify my judge because you don't like the color of his shirt? Or lack of color of his shirt?
So, as the case may be? So if we're entering into a contract, so then we get to decide what the rules are.
Maybe. You seem to be arguing along similar lines to what Shmuel was saying before, which was my initial intuition. I do think the case can be made for the opposite.
But that's why I don't want to sort of box them into Pshara and Din, because I think that it's possible that, you know, that everyone agrees that it's more of an issue of whether there are rules, and Pshara, both... Sorry.
And within
both
Pshara,
Pshara
you
and Din can go into
okay,
the Chachamim's
okay.
box,
okay.
but
okay.
Meir is much more of a Pshara.
I hear where you're coming from. But I think the case can be made in those categories as well. Now, we're going to... There are many, many nafkamina of this question. And we're not going to explore all of them, because we'd have to spend like 5 shiurim just exploring the nafkamina of this question. There are some that I want to take a look at. And a couple of notes to think about before we begin pursuing some of these nafkamina. I'll have to carefully select which ones we look at and which ones we don't. But one thing to look at whenever you're looking at a nafkamina in general, I don't know if it's going to apply to every single case here, but you always have to look at the principle that we're trying to examine, as well as the particular application. Whenever you're trying to apply a broad principle to a particular circumstance, you have to consider both principle of the matter, but you also have to consider the way the technicalities of the particular circumstance can influence your question. So, if you want to talk about the conceptual nature of chalipin, right? Chalipin is what's known as kinyan sudr. It's a symbolic transaction. We do it when we do mechiras chametz, and there are certain cases where you can do some form of transaction through a symbolic picking up of a handkerchief or a pen or something like that. We have similar things that are done at weddings. You'll see the fathers or the representatives picking up a pen at the chasen stish. So it's something called chalipin. So, and then there's a big question about the mechanics of chalipin. Is chalipin really a form of kesef? Is it a form of monetary transaction, like Kenyan kesef? Is it something else entirely? So let's say I wanted to explore that question. I came across the Gemara Kiddushin Daf Gimel that says, has a machlokas whether or not I could use chalipin for Kiddushin, right? So part of me says, jackpot, this will determine whether or not chalipin is kesef, which works for kiddushin, or not, right? But you have to keep in mind that not only do you have your broad question about chalipin, you have lots of questions about kiddushin as well, the internal dynamics of kiddushin. It's quite possible that chalipin is a form of kesef. There's a bit the example requires a little bit of background knowledge, but it's quite possible that chalipin is a form of kesef, but still doesn't work for kiddushin, because there are many things that are kesef that don't work for kiddushin. Kiddushin requires higher standards, kesef shel hana, and other things like that. And this works in many, many, these are just stock examples, a lot of them happen to come from the first parak of kiddushin, about if you want to understand a principle, you can't properly understand it without being sensitive to the applications as well. If I want to understand whether or not a mashkon works for kiddushin, a mashkon is a collateral that you give when there's a loan. So the person will collect the mashkon if I don't pay it back. And there's a discussion on the Gemara Kiddushin Daf Ches whether or not mashkon works for kiddushin. So that could be telling me something very important about the nature of mashkon, right? But it might not. It could be telling me something about kiddushin instead, right? So whenever I'm studying a principle, I have to pay attention to the principle, but also to the I have to be sensitive to the applications as well. So then in mind, let's take a look at some of the nafkamina here. I think it's the first one, at least, is going to be pretty straightforward, and hopefully we'll get through the first two, at least. And then we'll get through some of the more involved ones next week, and then we'll move on to hopefully our next topic. But next week, are we going to have Shir? We'll have to decide. It's going to be Motzai Rosh Hashanah. Tzom Gedal, after Tzom Gedalia. We'll see. I'll try to gauge whether or not there's interest. And then the next week is going to be Yom Kippur. So that we probably will not have Shir Motzai Yom Kippur. But hopefully we'll try, and once the Chagim...
After Kiddush Levana.
Exactly, before. we'll sing and dance a little bit, and then, yeah, okay. Hopefully after the Chagim, we'll get into a little bit more of a normal routine. So, one case where this broad conceptual question comes up, almost explicitly, is in the Tur and the Bach, in sources 8 and 9. Now, a little bit of note, a quick note about the organization of the Tur versus the organization of the Rambam. When the Tur organizes Choshen Mishpat, he goes through some basic halachos of judges, who's kosher and who's not kosher, things like that. And he goes through the halachos of, in Siman Beis, he talks about the important principle of Beis Din Makim Onshin Shelo Min HaTorah, the discretion that Beis Din has to, in certain cases, institute punishments that aren't even Torah punishments. A very important sugya. Beis Din has the... We always talk about, so you need two witnesses and a warning, and the guy has to say, I don't care about your warning, and do it anyway, and then they're punished. What kind of koach does that leave Beis Din? So the answer is that there's a principle on the Gemara Sanhedrin Mevav that Beis Din has the ability to punish in many circumstances, even in the absence of those high standards. Then, the Tur mentions Pshara and Siman Yud Beis, then Zeborer, and then starts getting into some of the more formal elements of Beis Din. Pshara, Zeborer, formal elements of Beis Din. By contrast, the Rambam starts by talking about the halachos of Sanhedrin, and he waits to talk about Pshara until way later in Hilchos Sanhedrin. He doesn't even mention the concept of Pshara until, I think, Perek Chav Zayin of Hilchos Sanhedrin. So is that important? What might that reflect or not reflect?
The Rambam is a much broader scope than the Torah.
I wouldn't say broader scope, but it's a different organizational scheme. But some people want to say, the Tur's organization shows you that he views there to be some kind of hierarchy or spectrum between Pshara, then Zeborer, and then Din. That's what some people try to say. Whereas the Rambam doesn't mention Pshara until way later. Zeborer has nothing to do with Pshara. That's the Rambam's argument. We'll talk about the Rambam's organization when we get to the Sugya Daf Chav Dalet of Naaman Alei Abba, which will be a little while, but when we get to that, we'll talk about the Rambam's organization.
The Tur doesn't have to discuss, capital punishment, so that's part... You don't have Pshara...
The point that you're highlighting is that the Tur... I don't think that's a fair deal. And this relates to a broader methodological point regarding the organization of the Rambam versus the organization of the Tur. The Rambam is organized as a conceptual work. It's organized conceptually. There are principles, right? The Tur is organized as a practical guide. Mashal Amad Dever Dome. You open up Hilchos Pesach. What does the Tur in the Shulchan Aruch start with? So it's Hagalas Kalim. Hagalas Kalim. How your kasha your Kalim. Now, would the Rambam ever put Hagalas Kalim in Hilchos Pesach? Not a chance. He mentions it because there are certain halachos that where Chametz differs from the rest of Yisurim. Where does the Rambam put these things? He's going to put them in Hilchos Ma'achalos Asuros. Because conceptually, Hagalah has nothing to do with the halachos of Chametz U'matzah. He wouldn't put it in Hilchos Chametz U'matzah. It doesn't have to do with the laws of Pesach. Conceptually, it has to do with Ma'achalos Asuros. The Tur is giving you a practical guide for how you approach the holiday of Passover. And how do you do that? You start by kashering all your kalim. So you start with Hilchos Hagalas kalim. As I mentioned before, the halacha states that whenever disputants come before Beis Din, what does Beis Din start by offering them? They start by telling them, would you like to do Pshara? So what does the Tur start with? He starts with Pshara. Then he talks about Zeborer, because if they can't agree to a Pshara, then they'll do a Zeborer, and in certain cases you'll have a formal Beis Din as well. Whereas the Rambam is going to put Pshara way later in Hilchos Sanhedrin, because if we're talking about the fundamentals of Sanhedrin, Pshara is an entirely different concept. So I don't think it's fair to justify any conceptual approaches based on the organization and the organization alone. But there is an important Bach. So let's take a look at the beginning of the Tur in Siman Yud Gimel. Siman Yud Gimel is where we talk about Zeborer and how he formulates this and what the Bach derives from it. The Tur begins. Lo nisratzu b'pshara. So first you offer them pshara. That's what the Tur mentions in Siman Yud Beis. And then if they don't want pshara, el b'din, but rather they want a standard din of Choshen Mishpat, v'ratzu ladon kan, and they want to have their case here, Elisha ein maskimim shnehem lifnei eza shlosha yadunu. They want to have it here, that they know, What happens if one of them wants it in Minsk and the other wants it in Pinsk? One of them wants it here, the other one wants it in California? That's the next subject that we'll address. But this is a case where they both want it here. They just can't agree on which basin they want to use here. Paskins like the Chachamim, obviously. Whenever we have machlokas between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir, whenever we have machlokas between anyone and Rabbi Meir, we paskin against Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir gets the short end of the stick in that regard. But, almost always. But he says that they do go through this process of Zeborer, and the two Dayanim appoint the third. You only need the Haskama of the judges. Look what the box says. Source 9. Kaza Rabbeinu, Hadayanin Borin Lahan Od Shlishi, the two are paskins like the Chachamim. V'herich Rabbeinu lichtov lo nisratzu b'pshara. He says the two deliberately prefaces the simon with lo nisratzu b'pshara. They didn't want pshara. Now, if you would have asked me, I would have said that the two is just describing the progression of the case. You offer them pshara, they don't want it, this is what you do. But the Bach thinks that there's great significance to the fact that the Torah begins this simon with lo nisratzu b'pshara. What does it mean? Le'oruye, this is to teach you, to dinzeh, that this halacha, that the two judges appoint the third one, without the consensus of the litigants, this is specifically ze'eno elok she'lo nisratzu b'pshara. This is specifically when they don't want pshara. Aval nisratzu b'pshara, but if they do want pshara, v'zeh bor lo echad, and within the framework of pshara, each one appoints his own judge. Within pshara, are the judges licensed to appoint a third without the consensus of the ba'al edinim? The Bach says, no way. So the Torah is deliberately telling you that there is a distinction between zeborer and pshara. Within pshara, if pshara were true, then the judges would not be able to choose a third one without the haskama of the ba'al edinim. Because this is not pshara, the two judges are able to do so. And he adds, this is exactly what the Mishnah is saying as well. This is what the Mishnah means to say as well. He says, why does our Mishnah start with Dine Mamonos Peshlosha Zebor Lo Echad? Why does it start with that phrase that Dine Mamonos requires three? Why do you need to start our perek by telling us that a Beis Din has three people? It started the first Mishnah Masechet Sanhedrin tells us that a Beis Din has three people. Specifically within the framework of Dine Mamonos Peshlosha, there you have this halacha where the Chachamim say that the two judges appoint the third. Aval b'pshara delo b'inan shlosha. But in pshara, where you could have two people or even one person, if it's pshara, then even if they decide to do that system where each one appoints his own, the third one must be chosen with the consensus of the ba'al edin. You can't have the two judges acting independently to choose the third. What is the Bach doing here? He's saying that the Mishnah is going out of its way to distinguish our case from pshara. You would have a hava amina that this is operating under the same grounds of pshara, or that pshara operates under the same grounds as zeborer lo echad. That there's some conflation between pshara and zeborer. Either that both of them require the haskama of the ba'al edinim, or that in both of them the dayanim, the first two judges, can themselves freelance and choose the third dayan. Comes the Mishnah in the language of the Torah to explicitly draw a distinction between pshara and zeborer. What does that reflect? A, it reflects that we might have confused the two principles. The Bach is assuming that there's reason to conflate Zebora and Pshara, which would imply that they're similar. The question is always, what's the maskana? Once we reject that parallel, what are we saying? Are we rejecting the entire premise? That you're totally off base in assuming that Zebora has anything to do with Pshara? It's an entirely different principle that works more along the basis of Din than it does along the basis of Pshara. Or, no. Your premise was well-founded. There was good reason to assume that Zeborer is similar to Pshara. Indeed, Zeborer is similar to Pshara. But don't go as far as thinking that they're identical in terms of how you choose the third dayan. So the question of how you interpret Zeborer really emerges from the Hava Amina and potentially the Maskana of the Bach as well.
It's basically a lacha. If you say that ideally you would decide to go to a given beast in of three, and then only if you can't agree on a select group beast in of three, then you do this choosing process. If the Mishnah is talking about that, then there's no way it's pshara, because if you just go to a beast in of three, that's not pshara. You're trying to say Zabla is more pshara than a regular beast in.
Right.
But if the Zabla process is only after you can't agree on a beast in, then it can't be pshara. If the Mishnah is talking about that, then that's.
In other words, you're saying that the progression would not be pshara din pshara.
Right.
So what I would tell you is, yeah, 100%. That might lend some support to the notion that it's more within din. Even within the notion, I'm not saying that Zabla is fully pshara. I'm just saying that it fits more within the realm of arbitration. So I guess once we're rejecting pshara, the ideal would just be to go with the other paradigm, which is din. If din doesn't work, we're going to use this zeborer, and perhaps zeborer is, again, it's not fully pshara, you're 100% correct in asserting that, but it's something more akin to the arbitration of the first option than it is to the second option. In other words, you reject pshara, we want din. Din doesn't work out, what are we doing now? Now we have zeborer, which is this ambiguous middle ground, we don't know what it is, and we're trying to figure that out. So just to conclude, we have this important hakira about the nature of zeborer. Is zeborer a full base din, or is it something more akin to pshara, more akin to arbitration? We are arguing that, A, that could explain the machlokas bakadeshi yetzei adin la'amito, the machlokas rishonim as to whether they're actually advocating for their respective parties, or it's all within the minds of the litigants that they're going to go along with that decision. Number two, this can explain the machlokas in Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. We're not sure which direction, but it could potentially help us to understand where Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim are coming from. And number three, it's highly reflected in the language of the Torah and the Bach as to why we need this language of Dine Mamon Shpshlosh at the beginning of our Mishnah, and the whole language of Lo Nisratzu B'Pshara, the notion that you might have confused them, but in the end, the Torah is telling you that you should not, either because they're totally different, or because even though they are similar, there are still discrepancies. Going forward, next week, or whenever we next meet, we'll explore some of the nafkaminas, the ramification that this has for the process of Zeborer, the process of the Dayanim, who's kosher as a Dayan for Zeborer, might be radically different than our general standards for Kashas Dayanim. How do they go about the process of the Din Torah, again, might be significant differences between them. And how do they go? Are there going to be differences regarding the process of appointment? When can a person be chozer on his own appointment? When can they be chozer? When can they not? Those are all going to be important questions. And like I said before, for all of them, we'll consider both the general principle of Zebor Loecha, as well as the nuances of all the particular applications as well.
Okay. Here's your question. I'm still a little confused. Are we saying that